This episode was recorded for my UK column show. Please keep us independent by going to support.ukcolumn.org.
This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
Jamie Andrews, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Hi, Germ. Thank you for having me back again. It's really nice to join you just for an open chat this time. I think last time we went through some of the work that I did, but this time it's a bit more of an open discussion. That's what I wanted to do anyway.
Have you been following my unbelievably bizarre in exchange with this establishment hack by the name of Ian Copeland, PhD?
Yes, I have. The he talks a big game, right? And I think a lot of these pharmaceutical employees, shall we call them, are, you know, put out to kind of put this discourse on online, and it's unfortunate that a lot of people follow you know, his stream, and it's really kind of like the, you know, what's par for the course on social media these days is people are looking for the sick burn, aren't they? They're looking just for the pejoratives, how well you can give an appearance of authority, an appearance like you know what you're talking about, without actually displaying any kind of fundamental logic or indeed proof for what you're saying, right? And that's what Ian Copeland is very good at, is just, you know, sitting and grandstanding rather than actually providing any proof. Like you did, you said, you know, have you got any proof for what you're saying? And instead of actually just simply going, okay, here it is, they tend to just get further and further down, or change the subject, or, you know, we all know the ways that these people operate. But it's one of those questions, isn't it? That how long do you go on with it for? But one of the things that the crossover was where he presented a picture of SARS-CoV-2, or what he claims to be SARS-CoV-2, the imagery that they rolled out during 2020 with plushy toys, and stamped it on bus stops and media propaganda and everything like that, to ram it home that you knew what SARS-CoV-2 supposedly looked like, this round thing with all these spiky protrusions out of it. And Ian Copeland said, okay, well, what is this then? And I have just come off the back of releasing...
Well, that's where it started. Yeah.
Yeah, I've just come off the back of releasing some microscopy work. So it rang some alarm bells in me. Well, I know exactly what that is, because I've just been having a microscope session with an accredited microbiology lab looking at these things, but looking at these things where they couldn't possibly be, if that makes sense. This is often a point of confusion, so this is really why I wanted to discuss with you today and with your viewers that the thinking behind kind of what we're doing at the project, the Virology Control Studies project, and actually kind of break it down systematically, actually what the results mean, why we're doing what we're doing, and how to kind of move forward with the information that we're putting out. So we're taking healthy cells. We are taking a cell line that was used to quote-unquote isolate SARS-CoV-2. It's a Vero cell. It's a monkey kidney, an African green monkey, for some reason. And it's quite ironic, they couldn't actually get it to break down the supposed virus in a human sample. If you follow that kind of logic, they could not get a human sample to break down. They could only get the more fragile monkey sample to break down, which should kind of ring alarm bells. If they can't do it in vitro, how is this working in real life? And we took those cells, and what happens with this in clinical science is that they guarantee that these cells are completely sterile. So they cut them out. They make sure that they're free of bacteria. They obviously make sure that they're free of claimed viruses. So they PCR test them beforehand, and they give you a certificate. It's a certificate that says, we hereby declare that this cell line is free from any contaminants. You can use it and conduct science on it to make sure that what you are carrying out is a cause of what you're putting in it, if that makes sense. So when you carry out the experiment, at the end of it, you're supposed to be able to say with a lot of confidence that what we have carried out is not a cause of anything else, like a claimed virus or a claimed bacteria or anything like that. So we've taken these cell lines, we've conducted the control culture experiments, which we discussed on your show before, where we are taking the ingredients of the culturing method that they have, that they can claim that they can make a lot of this virus. So they take the cell, they take the cell line, and they. What we found out was is that there's a protocol called the M4A1, which is a World Health Organization accredited manual. It's a manuscript. And essentially, if you do not use this manuscript, you are not accredited by the World Health Organization. And therefore, to actually be an accredited virologist, you have to follow their guidelines. And in their guidelines, it says you must essentially remove the food. Okay, so the cells survive on a thing called fetal bovine serum, which is the heart from around the blood from around the heart of a baby cow. It's all pretty witchcraft stuff, you know. It's frog spawn, you know, eye of newt, frog toad, you know, witch's brew type thing. But they use all of these strange kind of concoctions to supposedly carry out legitimate science. It's fetal bovine serum, and they grow the cells using this. So you add this blood, this serum, to the cells, and they grow, and you can watch them grow under a light microscope. You can see them fill a petri dish, and then they add a sample. So they add either, say, spit or mucus or bronchoalveolar lavage, which comes from your chest, of a sick patient, or they take what they consider to be an isolated virus and they put it in. But what they don't tell you, the general public, but they do tell these accredited virology labs, is that they force you to reduce that fetal bovine serum, that the food for the cells. Effectively, they're feeding them, they're all happy, and then all of a sudden, when they come to claim infect it, they remove the food. So they've started a starvation environment. Now, they call it just a maintenance medium, but we've found out that that is indeed a lie. They remove the food, and what we've done is we've stopped at that point. We've done everything that the virologists do, but we didn't add a sample. So we've kept the progress of that cell line moving forward with no chance of a virus being in there, and then kept going. So we've used their same ingredients, we've reduced the fetal bovine serum, not added any chance of a virus being in there, and lo and behold, the cell has actually broken down, it's died, in exactly the same way that virologists claim that the cells died whilst being infected with SARS-CoV-2 or any other virus. They break down with exact morphological features that show things like vacuolation, which is just holes opening up in the cell line, rounding, which is where the cell rounds, ballooning, which is where it rounds and kind of floats off or expands exponentially, and or placking, where the cells aggregate together, cincture as well, which is a similar kind of function, and the independent accredited laboratory that was blinded to this. So as part of the as part of the project, we sourced independent accredited laboratories that had none the wiser. You can find them just as a layman, and me not having any credentials in virology was able to approach just a random in the United States and say, hey, look, I would like you to conduct this science, please. They didn't know that it was the actual legitimate negative control of the isolation process. We just said, we would like you to conduct that. They said, yes, that's absolutely fine. We gave them a protocol. The protocol, they said, looked absolutely fine. They did it, they carried it out, and they noted these morphological features. Now, they didn't know that this was anything to do with virology isolation. They just thought that we were growing the cell lines and starving them. But they noted the exact morphological features that were noted for saying that, right, there's SARS-CoV-2 in your dish now. And they noted 6 out of 9 of them. Now, you only need one to say that there's a dish in there. So to them, we had a very kind of infected cell line. And this is where it kind of segues back into Ian Copeland, is that we then took those cells and we took them to a microscopy lab. So in virological, because the claimed particles are on the nanoscale, they say that SARS-CoV-2 is about 100 nanometers in diameter, you have to look with a transmission electron microscope. So there's no possibility, like with a bacteria, you can just look at them with a light microscope. You can put a slide under with bacteria and you can see them moving about, because with a light microscope, you can have a live specimen. So you can plate up a specimen, you can look at them under a microscope and you can see them moving. It's a very visceral thing. Once you can see something moving, you definitely know that it exists. It's motile under its own steam. You can see it's the way that it moves. You can see the way that it interacts and behaves, and you can pick up a lot of information from that. Whereas, quite coincidentally, you can't with a claimed virus. You have to kill everything to look at the depth and resolution of where you would claim find a virus. You have to kill the cell, you have to fix it in a pretty noxious formaldehyde type substance, and then you have to bombard it with electrons. You have to stain it with a kind of metal oxide, and then you have to bombard it with electrons. And what you get back is a pretty grayscale, black and white fixed image. So, just to really kind of put it in perspective, when you see, and Ian Copeland does this a lot, and a lot of people I see do this a lot, is they make the claim that a virus is an intracellular parasite that can infect, i.e. go inside a cell, replicate, and then burst out, and you're infected. Well, they have absolutely no way of knowing that, okay? Because the only way of seeing this is to fix and kill the cell. You have to have a stationary cell. You can't take a cell line, cut it, because how they prepare it is they cut it with a very fine knife called a microtome, and it makes a very small slither, they plate it up and put it in. So you have a snapshot in time. There is no movement. You can't see, there is no natural progression of acclaimed virus or any particle for that matter, acclaimed exosome or vesicle or lysosome, there is no way to actually get a progression. If you think about it, you have a sample. As soon as you cut it and as soon as you kill it, that's it. That's the progression over. You can't just unkill it and then re-put it back in the microscope. It's dead. It's done. It's fixed. So when people claim that, we know that viruses enter into host cells, it's impossible to tell. By our own scientific means of and limits of microscopy, it's impossible to tell that. So anybody online that says, "Oh, we know that the viruses infect a host," is talking bullshit. You know, just from a technical point of view. So we took these and we had a look at these healthy, you know, supposedly, I mean, we had starved them according to the virology protocol, but we looked at those under a microscope. And actually, this time in the first experiment, we gave them to an independent laboratory and just said, "Hey, could you have a look at these for us and give us back some photos?" And they gave us back six images, and we managed to find quite a few of the morphological features of viruses. But this time, we went a little bit further, and we actually worked with the microbiology lab to for a couple of hours in a live session, a bit like we're doing now, and we directed them where we wanted to go over this cell line, so actually kind of have a look around this cell line. And what we found was stunning, really, in the fact that not just with Ian Copeland's round spiky ball, we found the morphological features, the exact shape and size and inclusions and morphological features of pretty much every single epidemic, pandemic, in quotation marks, causing virus. Ebola, Marburg, polio, SARS-CoV-2, measles, about 27 different morphological features. And what you really...
HIV?
HIV, yeah. I mean, HIV is a very silly one because you see them everywhere. Over HIV, according to the mainstream narrative, looks at looks like a fried egg. It's round and it's got a dark nucleus in the middle, and you see these exact things dotted all over the cell line. And what you come to see is that when these break down, and they're all in the same areas, so on the macro scale, when in the cell culture the laboratory technician was noting vacuolation that we mentioned earlier, which is just a hole opening up in the cell, we looked at those holes in transmission electron microscopy, and that's exactly where all of these little claimed particles are, the fried egg type things that they call HIV. They're all dotted around. There's a beautiful picture that we've put out with about 10 or 15 of the same fried egg type things. And what's happening is that the cell membrane is a pretty basic thing. It's just a kind of lipid wrapper, you know, a bit like a fat or an oil. When you get a fat or an oil, if you were to throw oil on water, it would blob. It would immediately go, because it's hydrophobic, it immediately forms these round blobs where it will float around in the water. Some of it will aggregate together, some of it will form kind of semi-coherent patterns, but in general it will form a kind of blob. You could see the same thing in a lava lamp, you know, where you have that, the difference between oil and water. Well, that's what you're getting with a cell membrane in inside the cell. And when that cell membrane breaks down, all of a sudden little bits blob off. They blob off like a lava lamp or like oil in water, and you just get these random patterns. And some of these blobs don't contain anything, so they're just empty. And these are called vesicles within biology. And everybody goes, "Okay, that's a vesicle." But as soon as these blobs contain anything. So they contain a little bit of nucleus that has broken off from inside the cell, or they contain some sort of patterns. A virologist all of a sudden gets an arrow, points at it, and goes, ah, that's a virus. Well, we were finding these exact blobs, these filled blobs, all over the place in our experiment that cannot possibly contain a virus. And so we have to kind of conclude that what they are doing, what the virologists are doing, is they're taking basic morphological features of cell lines that have been stressed and are dying, and they are claiming that these naturally occurring things, these patterns and these blobs, are essentially going to kill you, that they're viruses. And and probably this is what I wanted to discuss with you, Jeremy, because I know that we've discussed this kind of area before, is that what that signifies to me is that if you can falsify the physical thing that they're claiming is a virus, that to me means that a virus doesn't exist. And let me kind of flesh this out. And I would like to just, you know, ask your opinion or you know, see, you know, what you think of this. If I were to give an analogy, and people kind of, so somebody actually asked me on Twitter a couple of days ago, you know, break this down, the microscopy work, as a layman, you know, what are you doing? And this is the analogy that I give. What virologists are doing is they are flying over a forest. Okay, imagine they've taken a helicopter, they've flown over a forest, and they've taken pictures from a mile up over a forest. And they are pointing at pictures of photographs of bears and calling them Bigfoot. Okay, so they've seen a bear from 500 meters up in a helicopter. The bear's standing on its hind legs. You can see that it's kind of fuzzy, and you can see that the hair around its shoulders, and they're pointing and going, that's Bigfoot, that is. Okay, and what we're doing is we're taking the exact same helicopter, we're taking the same camera, we're taking it from the same height, but we're going to a forest where there cannot possibly be Bigfoot. It's, you know, just for argument's sake, it's an area that they've declared Bigfoot free. And we are taking the same pictures and showing that what they're pointing at is bears and not Bigfoot. And what we've done, and this is, you know, where I'd like to kind of discuss with you, is to say, okay, virologists have said that Bigfoot exists. They've said that this mythical thing exists, and the parameters that they've given are that it can be found in a petri dish. They go, this is where it is. It has a finite area for you to look. Okay, they go, in this petri dish is Bigfoot. Okay, if you can say within these defined parameters, Bigfoot is definitely not in there. What it is a bear. Then you have removed the possibility of Bigfoot existing within the parameters that they've set. And to me, that's why I confidently say viruses do not exist. Now, it's a point of contention that some people like to describe it as there's no evidence for viruses existing, or people are yet to prove their existence. But I'm a bit more bloody minded than that. I mean, I don't know where you lie on the question. But so going all the way back to Ian Copeland, when he shows me a picture of, right, well, this is SARS-CoV-2. I've seen plenty of those. I've seen plenty of those with the little spiky bits, with the round, you know, centers that are exactly the same size, and they're just free floating in these cell lines.
In a very, very short summary, what you actually are telling me is that, if I'm following you correctly, Jamie, what you have seen in the laboratory are particles that could be identified as viruses, but actually aren't.
Correct. What they do is that they say within microscopy, and there are plenty of peer-reviewed papers, for instance, with SARS-CoV-2, they know that, ironically, kidney tubules of a monkey kidney cell, or just kidney tubules in general, look identical to SARS-CoV-2. They released that in a paper called "Appearances Can Be Deceiving." Viral-like particles of negative renal biopsy in 2019. So they found identical particles in a place before SARS-CoV-2 was discovered, and said it was in a healthy cell line, it was in a healthy patient, they were showing no symptoms of it, it was before SARS-CoV-2 was supposedly around, and they're finding these particles. And so they're saying, okay, well, already we can't confirm by looking alone. By looking alone, you can't say whether... You can't confirm whether it is a virus or not. You have to have downstream methods. And those downstream methods are things like immunological staining, PCR, and genetics. Now, what I think that is a real key part to understanding the fraud of this science, the fraud of virology, and what you will come to see as genetics also. And this is a scientific it's a problem within the whole of modern science, really, is that they use things called inferences. So an inference is a meaning attached to a test. When you infer something, you take a test, it has no direct evidence, but you infer that the results of the test have some sort of meaning. So with a PCR test, what they're doing is that they are putting in a fluorescent dye. This is RT-qPCR, so the latest iteration of the PCR test. They take a sample and they knowingly take a fluorescent dye and they put the fluorescent dye into the sample. They then shine a laser at the fluorescent dye, and if the fluorescent dye fluoresces, they ascribe all of the meaning that they want that meaning to be. Okay, so if we just take a step back and again use a kind of analogy for what an inference is, you could do the same by taking a firework, for instance. And if you took a firework and you said, I'm putting in some gunpowder, okay, and some red dye or some green dye, and I set that firework off and the firework goes up and it bangs, and you say, well, that gunpowder was attached to genetics. That gunpowder, the firework went off because of its genetics. Okay, it sounds absurd, right? You would go, really? But that's what an inference is that you're saying cause and effect has been ascribed something that is not directly related to it. So what they're doing within PCR is that they're putting in a dye. They're putting in the gunpowder into the firework. And when that dye fluoresces that they put in, when that gunpowder in the firework goes off, they're saying, okay, well, that's because of this or this. And so all of these downstream methods that they have, the PCR, the genetics, the immunostaining, which is exactly the same, immunological staining, where they claim that they can have, where they can say that, oh, a virus goes into a cell, what they do is that they take a panned out view. You can't see it with quite the resolution of transmission electron microscopy. It's kind of whole cells, and they put a dye in. Again, they are putting in the cause and effect. It's not the cause and effect is seen in a direct manner. They are taking the dye, they're putting it in, and when the dye dies stuff, they're saying, okay, well, that's, well, that must mean that X, Y, and Z. And so when they're claiming that, you know, okay, we have other methods to verify whether this is cellular debris, whether this is a vesicle, whether this is a claimed exosome, as opposed to a virus, what they're actually talking about is just an inference. And I've spent a little bit of time with AI, as much as I like or dislike banging my head against the brick wall with it, because, you know, we all know what it's like. But I have, you know, got it to admit that essentially genetics, immunological staining, antibodies, all of these things are inferences alone. There is no concrete evidence. You can't even see the building blocks of genetics. It's impossible, according to modern science. Once again, you know, in a similar vein, they claim that the DNA is 2 meters long in your cell. In every cell of your body, DNA is 2 meters long. They claim that if you put all of your DNA in your body together, end on end, it will reach to Pluto and back 6 times, yet you can't see it. Yet there is no microscopy picture of the building blocks. There is no photo in existence of the building blocks, the A, T, C, and G. It just doesn't exist, because they say, ah, well, it's molecular. It can, you can put them end on end, and it goes to Pluto and back, but when you actually try and photograph it, it's elusive. It doesn't, it's camera shy. And so we, as part of the project, are kind of looking at this and really putting it on display just quite how loose all of these scientific premises are.
Wait. So are you saying that if you conclude that viruses don't exist, then you can also conclude that DNA doesn't exist?
DNA in general, I mean, I would say my kind of honest answer to that right now is probably I'm where I was with viruses a few years ago. There's no proof that DNA exists. To me, it's
but then hold on. How come my son looks like me, for example?
They're inheritable traits. I mean, inheritable traits are obvious. I'm not denying that there's obviously traits passed down from person to person. Now, if you put that into perspective, I'm just saying it's not caused by genetics. If you put that into perspective, offspring are coming out like their parents, you know, offspring of people come out looking like people. We have a pretty defined parameter. It's quite, you know, adult height is, you know, between a foot or something and 7 or 8 foot. It's a pretty, we're not getting people that are 20 foot, 30 foot high or an inch tall. There's a very small, you know, you're not, the offspring of pigs are mostly, you know, four-legged, you know, they're a couple of feet off the ground, you know, 4 or 5 foot long, you know, long, maybe a bit longer, I don't know. But, you know, the parameters are pretty finite, okay? There's not huge variations already. So in terms of inheritable traits, you know, obviously the world of epigenetics, really, where you're looking at stressors outside, is really the terrain theory of the genetics world, where you get extraneous pressures and they say, okay, well, your environment is changing your genetics. Okay. So really that's the kind of area that I would look at in terms of inheritable traits, because, okay, you're born in a certain way, but, and it's quite hard to predict, you know, what would change if your environment changed. probably one of the only best ways of looking at that would be to study claimed monozygotic twins. So you take twins that come from the same egg and follow them, and if they were in completely different environments, you know, maybe one in Saharan Africa and one in Iceland or something, you know, it would be interesting. I don't know if there are any cohort studies following that. In terms of inheritability, in terms of, you know, we obviously look like our parents, but there's no contention that genetics is the reason for that. And that's what I believe, is that when you actually look at genetics, the fundamentals are actually quite absurd, because they claim that everything goes on in a liquid within the nucleus, within the PCR test, within the genetics test. Everything is conducted in liquid format. Okay. But they claim that there's a string, a physical string of nucleotides. If you envisage what DNA is, and everybody should probably have that image ingrained into them through indoctrination of, you know, the general media and schooling and education system and everything, you'll be able to know that it's a helical pattern and it sticks together like that. By the way, the two sides are negatively charged. They say that the two sides are negatively charged, so they're constantly repelling, yet they stick together, which is a bit strange. So you have these two strings, a physical string. People will think, okay, it's a physical thing that you can hold. You know, when if you kind of think to school, maybe won't, but there's a standard way that people say that they extract DNA from strawberries. So you get dish soap and you get salt and you mash up a strawberry, and then you put it in an alcohol, and the alcohol separates off this jizz stuff, you know, it looks a little bit, it's gloop, yeah. And they say, right, that's the building blocks of life. Well, and by the way, that dish soap and salt and alcohol is used in all laboratories around the world. It's just very expensive dish soap. It's about 200 quid for some dish soap if you're going to do that in a genetics laboratory. I'm selling dish soap, by the way. If any genetics laboratories want to have some cut price extraction for DNA.
Jamie, I don't understand something. Why do they need all of this dish soap, etc., when apparently if you and I are just standing next to each other and, you know, I cough, you get infected.
That's right.
There's no dish soap required. No. Why do they need all this stuff?
Well, this is the thing, is that they want and they desperately need to pull you into that arena of inferences. They have to, because the moment that you actually try and look for direct evidence of this existing, it all falls apart, like we have done. We've looked for direct evidence, which is zooming in to the place where they say that these things are, and going, well, the things that you're pointing at shouldn't be there. You know, the things the physical particle is there come what may. So, you know, this is the reason why they say what they do, is because they desperately need you to be in the realm of inferences, in the realm of inventive reasoning, where cause and effect is usurped, really.
Why does any of this matter?
I think on a part.
I mean, could we argue that this is just merely academic wankery?
Yes. Well, it certainly is. You know, a lot of people kind of accuse me of you know, speaking in jargon, and I try to water it down as much as possible. I'm a layman. I come from no virological background whatsoever. I mean, my science background was 20 odd years ago. I had a degree in geology. And that was about it. It was an undergrad degree. I pissed about, smoked too much weed and drank and didn't pay attention and just got through with a degree and left. What I did see, interestingly enough, was we studied some anthropogenic, paleo climate data. And so I saw as, a 20-year-old, the scam behind climate science when I was at university. Again, that kind of, it's just jargon filled until you actually go and you have to listen to the jargon to be able to get to the other side. And that's kind of what I'm trying to do with virology is you have to use the terms that they use to be able, for instance, to do what we've done, which is approach a laboratory. Somewhat, and there's a little bit of leeway, but you have to be able to speak their language to tell them what to do. You have to be able to write a protocol, and so you have to use their terms somewhat to be able to describe what you're talking about. And I agree with you, it's complete wankery, and I don't really like engaging with it too much because I don't want to confuse people. I don't want to try and give an air of authority like I know more than everybody else because I'm using this terminology. No, I've just had to kind of learn their wankery to be able to do what I'm doing. So, I'm glad that you kind of call that out in the way that you do, because, I think it's important to say overall, I'm not sat there going, the cell culture work that we've done, it means anything. We're just falsifying it. We're just saying it's bollocks, right?
Sure. Yeah, but okay. So, but Jamie, my question is, why does any of this matter? How does it affect us on a daily level?
Yeah, the reason why I'm doing it, the project, is to make sure that 2020 never happens again. So we're working with some pretty high profile lawyers. We are putting together cases that are challenging the state to make sure that us as a populace have a sting in the tail that if they ever try and run 2020 again, that we have adequate backing that can say, it was a PCR scamdemic. The entire thing, most of biomedicine is and big pharma is predicated on the PCR. So that's really our focus, to make sure that we fully debunk it. And when they start to roll out, if they start to, hopefully they won't ever do it again. But if they ever start to roll it out and they say, oh, these PCR tests are popping up, the reason why, and the reason why it's so important to do what we're doing, is that to take out that PCR, they then cannot, it's impossible for them to fabricate the pandemic and the way that they fabricated it, because they say, all they're looking for is data metrics to say how many people are infected over here, how many people are infected over here. So that's kind of the wider scale politics, is just protecting yourself, understanding that the PCR is wholesale fraudulent. It's not just inaccurate. It doesn't test what it claims to test for. We have evidence of that. We'll release it later. I'm working in background doing that. But on a personal level, why does it matter? Now, you mentioned you cannot cough and kill your neighbor. This is one of the pervasive things of germ theories, is it wants to split up social interaction. I'm sure that all of us, pretty much on whatever side of the spectrum, whether you're fully jabbed up or whether you're, like me saying, genetics and viruses don't exist, on all of those spectrums, we were all heavily divided. And we were divided from 2020 through till now, and arguably way before that, with the germ theory, for the past couple of hundred years, where they claim that your neighbor or your own children can come back, they can cough on you, and their cough can kill you. Now, just that notion, if you want to believe that that happens, that turns your life into a very paranoid state. They're even claiming that the mainstream idea is that somewhat, you can do that even vaccinated, funnily enough, is that there is no way to protect yourself, you know, because they're having measles outbreaks in high vaccination areas. They're having, you know, having to have constant boosters. So even the mainstream idea, if you're following this with germ theory, is that the fundamentals are, is that your neighbor can kill you with their cough. And the real important reason why understanding the fraud of germ theory can alleviate you from all of the fear and really help sociologically is to understand that that's absurd. It's absolutely absurd for the simple reason that 200 years of published peer-reviewed data shows it so. Because this is really where I started on this journey, was looking at those published peer review papers where they take what they consider to be viruses and put them directly up people's noses. So going back to 1918, the Rosenau studies, which was conducted by the US Navy, where they took what they considered to be Spanish flu. They took 100 men and over the course of six separate periods in three islands in off the coast of the US, they put this stuff up people's noses, and not a single person got sick. And this transposes right the way across every single virus. There's HIV, and I watched your wonderful video with the chap who had been diagnosed with HIV and who had come off of his HIV meds. All power to him. You know, HIV, the longest, largest cohort study by Nancy Padian et al., and she hates the fact that it's brought up by people like me, so I'll do it. 175 discordant couples, HIV positive, HIV negative, are sexually active, and they follow these for 10 years. And in 10 years, not a single person seroconverted. So the negative in the couple got HIV positive from being regularly sexually active. That's damning. Scientific terms, that's it's game over. That's it. That's all you need. HIV does not spread. It doesn't exist, but it does not spread by sexual activity. And again, this is a real, real bad one sociologically. You know, they told homosexual people during the 80s that they were killing each other, you know, whereas it was Mr. Fauci that was rolling out deadly toxins like AZT, you know, that was killing people.
Yeah. And they were telling black people here in Africa that they were killing one another.
It's awful, yeah. I mean, obviously in South Africa where you are, you can see how much they you know, experiment on, you know, the black indigenous population. It's terrible. That, you know, Bill Gates and the
yeah, but listen to this. I'm interrupting you, but listen to this, Jamie. If you look at the AIDS data, South Africa's got quite a lot of it because we were pretty much the epicenter of the whole thing, the whole scam. When the president, Thabo Mbeki, tried to stop the antiretroviral rollout, the ARV campaign, I think it was in the early 2000s, it caused huge uproar, and he was removed from the presidency, and he was replaced by a new president by the name of Jacob Zuma, who then had a big pharmaceutical rollout of ARVs. If you look at the data, you'll see that there's this huge uptick in mortality just coincidentally when the ARV rollouts occurred.
Yes.
Why?
Yeah, that's it. Just whilst we're on the subject, you should talk to Anthony Brink. He was affiliated with the...
I have already.
Oh, you have? Great, yeah. He's a really good chap, and obviously worked very closely with Thabo and Becky to get him to pull AZT, which was, you know, an absolutely incredible feat to make sure that political, you know, process was taken off the line. You know, in South Africa, I think I'm right in saying that, you know, to get a mortgage, you have to have a blood test, an HIV test. You know, that's the way that they're That's the way that they are ramping up these numbers. You know, it's clear to see that, you know, if you want to be part of the usury system, and I don't recommend it really if you can get away with it, but, you know, it's inevitable, unfortunately, is that if you want to be a part of that system, if you want to get on the housing ladder, you have to have an AIDS test, an HIV test, effectively. And, you know, when you are beholden to a PCR test, which is what it is, you know, they can do whatever they want. And let me just say this, because, you know, I work and have interviewed with Kevin Brow, who has been the same, you know, for he's 70 years old now, but for the past 20 years has had an HIV diagnosis, and he just didn't know. He was that kind of mainstream of the mainstream thought, and nearly died a couple of times with some of the toxic medications that they're giving him. Nevirapine, he was on it for a couple of weeks and nearly died of liver failure. And finally, he's kind of figured out through 2020, really waking him up, and he stopped the ARVs and has never felt better in his life. I actually run the HIV Control Studies Project, which is a kind of side project, working with hundreds. There are literally hundreds of people that are signed up that have been diagnosed HIV positive that are have stopped for quite long periods of time. I think there's a chap on there that has been off ARVs for 12 years now. And is doing brilliant. You know, he's doing absolutely fine. Like your guest, I forget his name now. Was it Jonas? Anyway, the guest was superb, and just like him, you know, once, and we are the control study.
Quinton,
that's right.
Quinton.
Once we are the control study, you know, you and myself, we didn't take the toxic jabs through 2020. Oh, look, we're fine. We are the control study. We're a living, breathing control study that you do not need the jabs. Whatever level you're on of germ theory awareness, we are the control study, and they are the control study for HIV. You know, they're not taking these ARVs, the antiretroviral medications, and they're fine. You know, their data metrics may be saying otherwise, but this is what we discovered, is that we actually reverse engineered, and this is how I found out a lot of the information about the PCR test. And, you know, if you are in South Africa, if you are in these African countries that are forcing you to take these PCR tests to get a more mortgage, understand this, that we took these ARVs and we looked at them chemically, and what they are doing, they tell you, is that they're chelating magnesium. Okay, they chelate magnesium to keep your PCR test, your claimed viral load, down. Okay, so we know that the PCR test, which is verified by gel electrophoresis is, and they will tell you this in nanopore sequencing as well, it measures charge. That is their inference. That is their gunpowder in the firework. That is the blue dye in the petri dish. It's charge. They are measuring the amount of charge and then ascribing an inference to it. So there are numerous ways that you can affect the balance of charge, you know, with ionic things, you know, potassium. I wouldn't recommend it. I wouldn't recommend taking, you know, magnesium supplements or anything like that, because I don't believe in, you know, supplementation. I think that you should get, you know, everything through natural means. But, you know, in terms of, I released an article about a chap in America who he had been diagnosed HIV positive. He had a viral load taken. He actually went through ChatGPT and got ChatGPT to analyze the article that I put out, saying that it was all just charge. ChatGPT verified it, said, yes, the PCR is just testing charge, and gave him an entire protocol for reducing his blood ion level. He went back, he got tested, and his PCR test viral load just dropped off a cliff. He actually managed to alter what they were studying. So, you know, I think as people who were forced to take these PCR tests, you know, I would say fight it. I mean, especially if they're coming back and saying that it's positive, like Quentin, you know, but know the fact that they're not using adequate controls either, you know, within a PCR.
I'm wondering, Jamie, if we are, when I say we, I mean people, all right, getting caught up in paralysis by analysis. Mm. Quentin feels fine.
Yes.
He's healthy.
Yes.
He's living a normal life like you and I. and someone's saying, oh, no, hold on. This piece of paper here with this string of data says you're not fine.
Yes.
Now, I mean, at what point do you go, no, wait, what you're telling me is wrong. Mm.
That's right. No, you're very, very true in terms of the fact that, and this is not just viruses. You know, the big one is oncology now. You know, they're telling people they've just forced all these jabs into people, and now all of a sudden cancer rates are rising. You know, I think it's twofold. I think that people are genuinely getting sicker as a populace, as big pharma really starts to chuck more drugs at people. But also, I think a lot of that is just data fraud, exactly the same way that the scamdemics were created. Is that people are being falsely diagnosed, misdiagnosed with cancer, because did you know that they are using the PCR test to diagnose a lot of cancers, and they are planning to ramp that up too, with a lot of leukemia, pancreatic cancer, osteoporosis cancer, I think osteocancers as well, and kidney cancers is that I think that they are planning on trying to move the whole of oncology into kind of PCR and genetics diagnostics too. And so a lot of people are getting these cancer diagnoses where they go, oh, okay. And, you know, unfortunately, I dealt with a friend that his wife felt a bit tired and subjected herself to, you know, the medical establishment, and they told her she had leukemia. And it's awful, you know, they're going with these very low grade symptoms because they're being frightened into thinking that they need a test to tell them whether they're sick or not. Okay, I feel a bit, you know, I feel a bit stressed, you know, I've got a, you know, a stressful job. Okay. Gone are the days where the old school GPs in the UK used to say to practically 99% of people that came through their door is, you're stressed, you need to sit down, you need to relax and drink more water. Bye. You know, gone are those days where you have a kind of, you know, a general practitioner in the community. Now they're all just pharma reps that go, oh, okay, you're tired, you've got leukemia. You know, it's ridiculous. And so you make a very salient point that I think that it's incumbent for people to really listen to themselves. Do you actually feel sick? Have you tried just stopping for a little bit and not, you know, grokking your symptoms? Because this is the other thing is that, you know, largely on a day-to-day basis, you grok your own systems and you've got cancer of the face, right? You've oh, I feel a bit tired and I'm thirsty. Right, you got cancer. You know, you better get yourself to emergency quick sharp. So, you know, it's just listening to your own body and, you know, staying away. I mean, I stay away from the medical establishment. I'm going there for broken bones, you know, open lacerations, you know, physical trauma. That's it. You know, stitch me up, put a bone back together. Other than that, leave me alone. Thank you very much.
I would recommend, I don't know if you've seen this, but whoever's listening now should watch a documentary called House of Numbers. Mm. Came out, 12, 13 years ago, something like that. And it's about the HIV fraud, and he travels around the world seeing how they gather their data, and it is so corrupt.
Yeah, it's a fantastic documentary. Yeah, really enjoyed it, and You know, that's the thing is, you know, once you see the machinations of the way that the pharmaceutical industry works, the fact that the science is predicated on nothing, it's all smoke and mirrors, and it's a business to keep people sick for profit. You know, it's a shame, but there's a mass awakening, and I think. I think as a populace, we're moving forward.
Okay, that's all fine and well, but why do people get sick?
Yes, and it's a fantastic one, and I can answer it very. I've wrestled with it for a few years because obviously, you know, I get it all the time, practically daily, on social media, and I finally came to the succinct conclusion is that. It's really no departure away from anything that you already know. You get sick via everything that the mainstream media, the medical establishment tell you how you get sick with an immune system. It's just that viruses don't exist and the immune system neither. You know, the medical establishment, and I talked with Doc Malik and Dr. James Hill on a debate that I did with them, you know, is that And they agree, you know, they're anti-vaxxers. They haven't taken that step to, you know, no virus yet. I hope that they do. You know, we all agree, everybody agrees that you get sick by eating shit processed food, by stress, by what's in your environment, the chemicals in your environment, what they're spraying on the crops, what they're spraying in the air, what they're putting in pharmaceutical drugs, everything, the stress, the psychological stress that you're under, everything, the mainstream media will even say, or the mainstream medical establishment will also say that radiation, you know, high doses of that, maybe they don't quite, you know, admit that it is as has the type of effect that it does. But everything that they say that quote unquote affects the immune system is all the things that does make you sick. It's as simple as that. So, what makes you sick, everybody agrees on. It's just that there are no viruses in the immune system. That you cut out the middleman. You're actually removing all of the sophistry, all of the bullshit science, and just saying, yep, we all agree, McDonald's, eating bad, drinking shit water, taking too many pharmaceutical drugs, drinking too much, smoking too much, and stress causes disease. It's as simple as that. And as soon as you just remove those things from your environment, you will find that you don't get those seasonal flus because it's just a detox. What goes in must come out. It's as simple as that. If you're constantly drinking, if you're constantly smoking, if you're constantly eating shit food, it's got to come out somehow. And it comes out, you know, those chemicals that are put in there, like, you know, in fast food, that for the preservatives and stuff like that, the preservatives are not natural. Your body knows that they're not natural. They don't need them. And if it can't, like food poisoning, just directly get them out through diarrhea or vomiting, it has to come out in the blood. And that's all that the flu is a symptomology where those chemicals go into the blood. They need to get them out. The kidneys, the liver take them out, they process them, and then you expel them through a high fever, sweating. You sweat them out through the largest organ in your body. You project them out of your lungs if you've breathed them in through mucus and so on and so forth. Biology is very, very simple. You know, people think that.
Sorry, I'm jumping in here, but I don't think that the average person would disagree with you. I think where the mental block comes in is when it happens collectively.
Yes.
Like children going to school and then all getting chickenpox.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, when you look at these things, you know, I mean, why do they all get them at the same time? Well, they're all jabbed at the same time, aren't they? They're forcing these kids, you know, it's unfortunate in a lot of schools and a lot of jurisdictions, you know, that they are enforcing for you to be able to go to school. You have to have, you have to inject your kids with the, you know, the childhood vaccine schedule. They're all getting jabbed at the same time. And lo and behold, they're all getting detoxing and getting sick at the same time.
Sorry, I know that the German new medicine theory argues that it's probably related to separation anxiety, kids being put into an environment that they're not particularly used to. They're away from their parents, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, German New Medicine is interesting. I don't particularly agree with how kind of extreme it is by saying that it's all psychological stress, because I don't believe that. But I believe that stress is a big, big driver of disease. And yeah, I mean, schools are indoctrination camps. You know, unfortunately, going through it with my kids is that, you know, we're kind of fortunate here that we're very, very rural. So the schools, you know, there's only eight kids in a class, and you know, it's a bike ride away. So that anxiety is not so much. But you know, a lot of kids, you know, they're sending them off. They, you know, you're separating from parents at a young age, and yeah, you know, they're with strangers, and the whole concept is a bit kind of, well, you know, statist and government like, really, isn't it? You know, they're kind of just taking your kids, right? And I think you're probably right, is that, you know, that has, you know, a lot to do with disease. You know, if you're unhappy, if you're stressed, if you're depressed, you're going to get sick, because your body is out of balance. Your body likes to be happy and fed good stuff, just like those cells in the petri dish. It likes to be fed the nutritious stuff that it wants, and as soon as that it stops, and as soon as it starts being poisoned by the antibiotics that it puts in, and the formaldehyde, you know, it breaks down and it dies. And
okay, Jamie, how can my audience follow your work?
I am releasing everything on Substack. I do everything kind of in long format articles, but we also release all of the experiments open source for free for you to go and look. I've just released all of the transmission electron microscopy. There's a couple of hundred pictures on there of all of the work that we've done. I'll also be releasing the 2-hour video next week. That's Substack. Substack.com/controlstudies. I think you might put it in a link below. You can follow me on Twitter at Jamie_A again, because I've been banned so many times. That's more of just a kind of trolls come along and you know, just shooting the breeze. All of the main work is on Substack, but if you want to just say, hey Jamie, how's it going, you know, I'm on Twitter too.
Jamie Andrews, thank you for joining me in the trenches.